having a work session on Senate Bill 6538, the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. Mr. Mangus, would you like to come back up to the table and Prince Washington? Christy, do you have some comments to make?
Good morning. My name is Christy Nickram, Legislative Fiscal Office, and on February 1st and 2nd, we were here for the public hearing and public testimony, and we began work session on Senate Bill 5538 for the Department of Veterans Affairs. And at that time, I had started going through the spreadsheet. I've handed out revised spreadsheets and a memorandum. So the ones you already have, you can talk. And I will just start with the spreadsheet, and unless there's some questions, we can begin going through the spreadsheet and the memorandum. Okay, the legislatively approved budget for 97-99 was $1,555,910,739. I'm not used to so many numbers. there were reductions for the veteran home positions that were taken out, and that was an administrative reduction of $4,362,979.73.93 FTE. The merit increase was $220,791. The department reduced their debt and loan portfolio with a reduction of $670,917,360. A vacancy savings change was an increase of $104,238. There was a personal services reduction of $426,262. And then there is a phase-in for the program costs for the veterans' home. This will be their first full biennium, and that is $11,602,761. The inflationary increases were a reduction of $1,638,465, and state government service charges were $420,946, and the last adjustment was the PERS adjustment of $174,479, and that brought us down to the current service level of $891,088,888, and FTE of 177.
Is there any discussion prior to moving ahead or any questions that the committee members might have? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At the $2,435,000 of general funds and the current service level, at that approximately $2.5 million figure, the local services to veterans will still be maintained at current service level. Is that correct?
County Veterans Service Office.
Yes, sir. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then coming back up to the other funds, the phase in for the veterans, the full service on the veterans home at $11,602,000. I'd like to just have some assurance that we are going to be meeting the standards that are placed upon us by both the federal and the state relative to the service levels that are necessary for the veterans. I assume this is for the facility in the Dells.
That's correct, and these are other funds which are federal funds. Mr. Mangus, would you like to respond to that question of meeting the criteria established by the federal government and the state government on the handling of patient care in your facility?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, you know, as we've explained before, we, rather than operate the home on our own, we've contracted with Diversified Health Services, and there is a standard that they have to meet as far as a employee-to-patient ratio, and they are meeting or exceeding that standard. The funds coming into the home, the resident at the current time pays $63 per day for all-inclusive care. That's matched by a daily per diem received from the federal VA. We work and have created a number of relationships with the federal VA, geriatric care and nursing home care, and pharmacy people, where they are on a drop-by basis, unannounced, coming in to do inspections to tell us, you know, where we have problems, what we should be looking for, just to keep us above board. We did have our first inspection by FDSD, and that we did get one substandard, and that's something you don't want to get. But that was in the Alzheimer care unit, and that was for patient-to-patient abuse. We have a little different mix. It doesn't make any difference. I mean, we have to be graded according to the standard used on all right. homes, but mm-hmm. our mix is a little bit different. We're, as in a private nursing home, it's probably a 90% female, 10% male ratio. Ours, it's just flipped, 90% veteran, 10% non-veteran. They're a little more aggressive, but we're learning on that. Taking the remote control to the TV away from an individual is patient-to-patient abuse. In this case, one of the patients pushed another patient and scratched him, and in that case, we had to remove the one individual from the home, and we transferred him to the VA hospital in Portland. So they have increased the staffing level in the dementia care area. The others, things that we were graded on was, one, we did not register the individuals to vote quickly enough. We did not have blue cheese dressing. And there was not enough salad or fresh fruit available on that. But that's the same standards everybody was graded on. We got a lot of compliments on the home. The family members of the individuals there, we have a lot of testimonials that they gave to FDSD. Now, FDSD will come back, and then we had to work with Diversified Health to develop a plan to meet the areas, you know, where we were graded, and then they will do another drop-by to re-inspect on that, and then we will be scheduled, well, not scheduled, because it's unannounced visits annually at their discretion. Come by to inspect the home. Plus, there's a local nursing home ombudsperson located in the Dalles who we work closely with. And then again, the VA hospital. And they've been very cooperative in trying to help us fix a new program. But it's, I think it's working out quite well. We had reached 91 residents. Which put us on schedule, but yesterday when I was checking my email, we were down to 88 as of Friday. We have a waiting list to get in, but what they suggested is that we screen the individuals more closely for the Alzheimer care unit to make sure that they're not rated for psychiatric disabilities, too, that would make them progressive.
Right.
And if that was the case, then you know, you would withhold admissions on those individuals because it wasn't created to have a psychiatric care. But I think we're doing it.
Great. Mr. Chair, I'm satisfied that the necessary measures have probably been implemented. I'm wondering if perhaps following the next FDSD inspection of the Alzheimer's unit with their satisfactory scoring, that perhaps the veterans could return to the emergency board to just return a report that is satisfactorily being accomplished. I'm satisfied that they're taking the necessary measures. I think the public needs that assurance from the board and would request.
That's fine, we can develop the budget.
Thank you very much.
You know what that.
To comment on that, but I think that is a good idea because headlines like, you know, Alzheimer's patients fight at veterans' home, if you get a good rating, that doesn't make the headlines. When you do a good job, it doesn't make the headlines. And so I think that if SCSD comes back with a report that brings you back up, that we should hear about that so that we can erase that silly headline.
Chairman, some of the people, what we did find is the headline in the Dallas paper was kind of a downer, but the article wasn't all that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But now that it got picked up on the wire, it got condensed further on down. By the time it got to Ashland, it just made it sound bad. But yeah, we'd be happy to come back. And I think that's probably good.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Thanks.
Further questions? Representative Schrader, you raised your hand a moment ago. Did you have a question?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Further questions? Representative Patrick would now move the Legislative Fiscal Office recommendation of a total budget of
$891,888.88.
It's current service level right here, the first dark line. And 177 FTE. Is there discussions?
Yes, sir, we are.
Is there objections?
This is just the current service level.
Just the current service level. Is there objection? If not, it's going to be approved. Okay, Christy, you want to talk about the governor's revised budget, recommended budget?
We have, there are several things in addition happening on this spreadsheet. The first thing we want to talk about are the packages for the governor's recommended budget. And if you'll turn to the second page of the spreadsheet, package 101 is a package which replaces the microfilm indexing software that isn't year 2000 compliant. VA has over 9,000 reels of microfilm which must be accessed to locate loan information. And the software is outdated and the software vendor doesn't provide service and maintenance beyond 1998. So this is for $252,423,000 other funds, and the Legislative Fiscal Office recommends approval of the request.
Would you like to do each one? Why don't we deal with each one and then we can go back and work session either approve or reject whichever one they want to.
Package 102 is also in the loan program, and this package replaces outdated microfilm image capture and retrieval equipment. The equipment is over 12 years old and it's considered obsolete. There are frequent repairs, replacement parts are difficult to locate, and it requires the costly service agreement. The new equipment would be more cost-effective and provide a longer service life. This package is for $150,000 other funds, and the Legislative Fiscal Office recommends approval of the request. The third package is 103 in the Veterans Services Program, and this is for $23,320 general fund. The Veterans Affairs provides financial assistance to counties for their work on behalf of veterans across the state. This package provides $14,160 to maintain the current level of training provided to county Veterans Service Offices and Veterans Service Organization personnel. The package also provides an increase of $9,160 in the Educational Assistance Program to cover additional program training. Participants. The Legislative Fiscal Office recommends approval of this request. Package 105 in the loan program is for $91,500 other funds, and this would replace four older air conditioning units. The current cooling system is 16 years old, and the department's tooling needs far exceeds equipment's abilities. If you recall, the department owns their building, and so they have these type of costs that they need to take care of. Package 10, and Legislative Fiscal Office recommends approval of the request. Package 106 is also in the loan program, and it's for $50,000 other funds. And this package would complete the replacement of the 16-year-old carpet in the building, which began in the current biennium and is about 50% complete. The Legislative Fiscal Office recommends approval of the request. And those are the five packages.
You've heard the recommendation. Is there any questions? Representative Patrick.
I was looking at the memo and I saw everything except package 103 for the check mark.
Okay, Representative Best.
I move package 101 for $252,000 for $252,423.
Representative Best now moves the microfilm software package $252,423. Is there a discussion? Is there objection? If not, it's been so approved. Package 102. Somebody want to make a motion? Representative Schrader makes a motion that the committee approve the package 102 microfilm retrieval equipment. This is $150,000 of other funds. Is there a discussion? If not, is there objection? If not, it's been so approved.
Mr. Chair, I just have a question of Mr. Nicklin. The microfilm software and retrieval equipment is probably good, has a sufficient life to take it through the time when they'll be ready to digitize some of this information. I assume that we're working towards that in all of these kinds of departments. I know that I see it in other departments where microfilming is still a lot cheaper to proceed. They can do so many documents so much faster and so easily retrieved uniformly. But I assume that we're moving towards that in other departments as we start to examine the cost. I just hesitate to spend $400,000 and then next year have the cost of the digital move the other direction. I assume that the legislative fiscal has examined that.
Yeah. Mr. Mangus, would you like to respond to that, too?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, we're looking at all types of ways to store and retrieve information. Again, we have to be as cost-effective as we can the way we go about it. As the portfolio declines, it may not be to our advantage financially to go to digital storage of information and retrieval. This equipment, the hardware and software, should last us, I would say, through the life of the program. And that's the most cost-effective for us at the present time.
I know that microfilming is the most cost-effective throughout at this time because so many other agencies are using it and have examined the it sounds like this is the answer right here, that the equipment expires about the same time that the program does. So then
I'll tell you what, Kenny Butler, it was probably one of the worst decisions that we had ever made way back in the 70s is going this direction. But we have to sometimes, to build one loan file, we have to go back and probably pull up the 20 reels of microfilm just to rebuild one file. This will speed it up, but if digital storage is, of course, it wasn't really available when all these transitions were happening, but this should handle it throughout the remaining life of the program.
Thank you, Chrissy. Do you want to make any comments?
No.
Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Beach.
I was wondering, apparently we own the building, and I'm assuming we have some sort of a sinking fund for maintenance and things like that. I was curious as to whether we also do it for equipment and repair. I mean,
We have 16-year-old air conditioning. I'm surprised it's still working. 16-year-old carpeting. I'm surprised nobody's killed themselves on it yet. And software that the manufacturer doesn't even support anymore. I was just wondering if we have some plan for the future to make it possible to upgrade some of the stuff a little sooner.
Well, that's what this basically is coming out of. These are all other funds. They're set-aside funds that the agency has determined to use for replacement and maintenance. They also rent out part of their facilities, and they receive net rent income from other agencies for the use of the veterans' building over here on summer, winter, spring, or fall street. I'm not sure. But they receive income off of renting out to other state agencies. Mr. Mangus?
And Mr. Chairman, I would say that from the very beginning in 1984 when the building was completed, it's probably one of the few on the mall that has not had deferred maintenance. It is up to date. This equipment has worked fine up until this point on the microfilm units, but it's not Y2K compliant, and the manufacturer has no intention of upgrading it. And so that's, you know, it's cumbersome, but we've made do. Because we do it as it becomes necessary to do.
We just got lucky and stuff left. I mean, I figured the building must be 16 years old because things seem to be coming out right around there.
You'd have to meet our business services people. I mean, they're outstanding. And these air conditioning units that you're talking about here are smaller units that are internal to the building, not with the HVAC system. In the computer area, the switch, communication switching area, cashiering, mostly because the equipment creates more heat. And these are smaller units that are replacing the ones that were in existence before. But the HVAC system handles the rest of the building. And I invite anybody here to come and look at the building anytime they want. It's in good shape.
Okay.
Chair.
Representative Butler.
It's my pleasure to recommend package 103, the ODBA providing financial assistance to counties for work across the state on behalf of the
Representative Butler now moves that the committee adopt the governor's recommended budget on package 103, county financial aid and education, $23,320 of general fund money. Is there a discussion?
Chair.
Senator Lynn.
This is 103 comes from the general fund, and why this is coming from the general fund. All those things, like all the funds for this is only coming from general fund.
The county veteran service officers are funded out of the general fund, Senator. The reason they are is the other funds coming out of the Veterans Home Loan Program have to be used purely for the administration at Department of Veterans Affairs. General fund appropriates some money to counties for veteran services officer, and the veteran service officer in the county goes out and raises additional veterans benefits for veterans residing in that county. I don't know, John, is there a prohibition on using other, you can't use veteran home loan funds to fund that activity, isn't that correct?
Chairman, the Oregon Constitution was modified in 1977 to allow the use of those funds for service officers and that side of the program. But a decision was made some time ago when we were $850 million in the hole that not to use those funds because of the impact it has on the cash flow and the ability to pay future debt service. And so it was changed. And the second question was, does the federal tax code allow you to use proceeds initially from the sale of bonds and then the repayment of those bonds to fund programs outside of the scope of what you're allowed to use qualified veteran mortgage bonds for? So that's why we're general fund in that area.
Senator Goods?
Mr. Chair, this is a pretty tight-run agency, but this particular package is underfunded. It's inadequate for what they need out there at the county level. We've had discussion, And I thought it was a month ago, so you saw what shape I'm in. I didn't realize it 3 months ago when we did this budget about the possibility as we were taking 10% off or whatever the heck it was of each budget. But we've only, we haven't done general fund budgets since then. But we talked about if we could raise enough. $1,000 for each county that has a service officer would give a, come up to $66,000 for biennium, giving each county an additional $1,000. A year, which isn't a lot, but then when the counties add to that, it does quite a bit of help. My concern is that these veterans are getting older, and as they die, you've got widows. We keep adding veterans to the system, and it's not adequate out there at the county level. So my question is, have we added anything to our list of, I mean, of resources available? $66,000 isn't a lot of money.
Senator, I don't disagree with what you're saying. We did not take the 2%, 4%, or 10% reduction on this. It's being held harmless. So I understand what you've said. As far as adding back the additional funds, I believe the governor said he would veto any bill that deviated in general funds above his recommended budget. So if you want to take your concerns to the middle office on the second floor, I'm sure they'd be glad to accommodate you. But our walking instructions in this committee is to stay with the governor's recommended budget and move in that direction. Mr. Mangus is here to champion that, and we're here to accommodate that. But we have not been empowered by the co-chairs or anyone else to add $1,000 or $1. And I'm not trying to say that in a mean-spirited way. We just simply have not been given the green light to add anything or deviate from what the co-chairs have recommended. Representative Butler?
Mr. Chair, I'll just make a comment, and that is that these funds are parlayed at the county level, at the local level, and they're really utilized many, many times over, and there's a huge amount of good that the counties receive. Could they receive more benefit for a dollar added to the budget? Yes, they probably could, but I don't want to give any kinds of motions of disincentives to counties to continue to go forth and do good with the money that we are able to give them from the general fund, and that's why my motion was up to $23,320.
Okay, you've heard the motion. Is there further discussion? Not, is there objection to approval of the recommendation? Package 103 is approved. Package 105.
Mr. Chair, I move that relative to packages 105 and 106, which deal with the air conditioning and the carpeting of the facility, which both of which appear to be substantially aging and wearing, and the utility of which is somewhat questionable, that 105 be approved at the $91,500, and at 106 be approved at the $50,000 from other funds.
We've heard the motion by Representative Butler to approve package 105 at $91,500, other funds for the air conditioning, and approve package 106. The carpeting issue at $50,000. Is there discussion? Is there objection? If not, it's been so approved. Vicki, anything else we have to do on this? We need to adopt the budget now. Representative Butler would like to have the department come back and report on the
as soon as the FDIC has made their subsequent inspection and that satisfactory inspection.
I need to go through the reverse now.
Okay. We have one more thing to do then. The governor's LFO recommended budget.
The department was asked to provide a 4% reduction option, 4% general funds. And the Department of Administrative Services had made some recommendations to accept the revisions. and the reductions that the department brought, and those were for $98,334. So if you'll turn to page 2 of the memo, we'll go through the reduction options and what my recommendations are. Did you hear?
Send your bids.
Okay, now I'm confused. I thought they were held on us.
Which page is every book in? I'll let Chrissy explain to you. They're helping harmless in the general fund.
$335
in reduction. Well, these are just technical adjustments based upon what the going rate is for the Attorney General and the State Treasurer and those things. But go ahead, Chrissy, and explain it.
Okay, the package 103 is an exception. They're being allowed to have this package even though it is general fund. The reductions that I'm making, the first one is page 2 of your memorandum.
That memorandum?
Yeah,
page 2.
And you can also refer back to the spreadsheet. The last box has some explanation of your further reductions. The state government service charges are being changed. That's package 030. The state treasury has made some major changes in for this department. For Veterans Affairs, it's a huge decrease in the amount that they'll have to pay to the Treasury Department for debt management. And that's a reduction of $586,780. The second adjustment to the state government service charges is the Attorney General fee reduction from $92 to $90, and that's an additional reduction of $10,480. So the total of the package 030 adjustments are $597,260. The next adjustment, the next list is the 4% reduction options that the department was asked to provide. And there are four adjustments here, which I'll just go through them real quickly. The first one was a vacancy savings. They have an administrative specialist that is retired, and they could reduce their personal services if they just hired the person back at the second step, and that would save them $19,354. And I'm recommending approval of this reduction option. The second vacancy savings is a benefits counselor that has retired, and this position could be refilled at the second step instead of the top level, just like the other one. And this would save the department $23,537, and I'm recommending approval of this reduction option. The third and the fourth reduction options that they offered would directly affect their services program, and I'm not recommending approval. It has to do with decreasing aged counties and eliminating a position in the Portland Claims Office, and this person helps veterans process claims. Now, if you approve the first two reductions, that would be a general fund reduction of $42,891, which is a 3% reduction. And I don't believe that this would damage the services program at all. So that was my recommendation.
Okay. Representative Patridge.
For clarity's sake, I thought that in the options 1 and 2 that you gave us, I thought DAS was supposed to have already done those things on their current service level.
Mm-hmm.
They make recommendations, but it's up to the committee to adjust it budgetary-wise.
I see what you mean. But these are just real recent. These are more recent. And go ahead.
My concern was, this one was 20. So these are just recent ones since the DAP budget has been, presented today.
Thanks, Washington. Mr. Chair, Representative Patrick. The dollars that you've identified in $98,000 plus were just reduction options that had been identified by the agency in April of this year. They had not been acted on in the budget. So each agency under the executive branch were asked to identify reduction options, and these were the ones identified by the Department of Veteran Affairs, but it was not an intent to reduce the budget by that amount, but primarily to identify where reasonable reductions might be possible.
Okay. Mr. Chair, just to... My concern is, are we playing on a level playing field? Not necessarily with this budget, and I appreciate the fact that these have been brought forward, but on the other budgets, you know, when they're having staff switches like that, we can run a little bit for the $42,000 in general fund savings in terms of this budget. Are the other, when the governor has his revised budget, are they doing that as well? Or are we going to have to go in and find that every single time? If there's other available options.
There's probably the individual's budget will be looked at depending on how much can be saved. It's like this budget, if they're really to get to their 4% level of general fund savings, you'd get the stuff to veteran service officers and they'd be totally eliminated. What we've tried to do is hold them harmless on the veteran service officers and reduce other areas, i.e. the Attorney General's costs, the State Treasurer's debt management costs, and those things to bring it in line, but still not hamper the effectiveness in the, of the department.
Mr. Chair, I understand that. I was just asking the other budgets, when you have changes in position, whether it's cost savings that are available that have occurred since the governor's original budget went out. I haven't had any one. This is the first time in any of the budget subcommittees that I've sat on, and I think Representative Schroeder and I sit on all the same budget committees, that they've come in with recommendations. So that's why I was wondering what the office policy is, or are they reporting on a typical basis, or is that a question we're going to have to ask?
You'll see more of it. You'll see more of it.
Okay. I'm trying to get a little less wet behind the ears.
No. You're going to see more of it, and I think you'll see a lot more of it once the employee management collective bargaining is agreed to. Then what they do is take the savings out of the agencies by not filling some of the positions, and that's how they meet the additional demand. So this is just the beginning of it, and you're going to see more of it to follow.
So at this point, Mr. Chair, I'd move the LFO reduction options in the amount of $42,891 in general fund.
Representative Patrick now moves the LFO recommendation of reduction package A, sub items 1 and 2, B, sub items 1, 2, and 3. Is there further discussion? Is there objection? Not, it's been so approved. Christy?
Based on the adjustments that you've made, if you look at the third page of the memo, we would amend Section 1 of Senate Bill 5538 to delete $2,458,361 general fund and insert $2,415,136. The second amendment would be to Section 2 of the bill and delete $337,060 and insert $36,730,135.
You've heard the issue, Representative Patridge.
Mr. Chair, I move to amend Section 1 of Senate Bill 5538, deleting $2,458,361 and inserting $2,415,136.
Representative Patridge, I move that we amend Section 1 of Senate Bill 5538. And we delete $2,458,361 and insert $2,415,136. Is there discussion? Is there objection? If not, it's been called through. Representative Patrick.
Mr. Chair, I just move to amend Section 2 of Senate Bill 5538, deleting $37,327,060 and inserting $36,730,135.
Representative Patrick now moves to amend Section 2 of Senate Bill 5538, deleting $37,327,060 and inserting $36,730,135. Is there discussion? Is there objection? If not, it's been so approved. That's finished. Are there any other budget notes or proposed considerations that committee members would like to give to this bill? Senator Lim?
The total budget reduction is up at 41.69%, but at the same time, the deduction of FTD is only at 28%. I'm not talking about if it's reduced to 41%, the FTD should be reduced to that much percentage, but compared to the reduction of the total budget, the reduction of the FTE is only 28%. Maybe even though we approved already approved it, but that's one of the points that we might be able to discuss at this point.
Sure.
I'm not to hear from
Mr. Bangers?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lim, that reduction 41% is in the non-limited funding area, and it has nothing to do with the FTE. It's strictly a reduction in our debt service from the current biennium to the next biennium, and that's only because of the bonds, the payments that we make on outstanding bonds. And what we've done is we've paid off a lot of that debt, and we've called a lot of that debt that paid off. And so if you look that in the previous, the current biennium, it was almost $1.5 billion in debt service as compared to the coming biennium, $851,000. That results strictly from the fact that we paid off this debt. And the only analogy I can use is it's kind of like, you know, having a money market account and calling the broker on the phone and asking him to do something, move money here or pay that, and then hanging up. We call the Treasury, and they make all the adjustments on that and pay the bonds as they come due. And we've just, you know, this is our heavy debt service period. If you look, Senator Hanna remembers the cash flows that we submitted back in the 80s, and it was this period right here from about 97 to 2003 when the heaviest amount of debt comes due. We're down, I think our outstanding debt right now is about $1.7 billion. In 1985, it was closer to $7 billion. So, I mean, this is what we've been paying off, but it has nothing to do with people.
Yes, Christy?
If I did do a calculation on just the operating portion of the budget, the operating budget is $39,145,000, and it is a 21% increase over the $97.99 estimated. So that is a little closer to the FTE reduction, relates more to it.
Further discussion, Representative Schrader.
I'd like to move House Bill 5538 to the floor with a two-pass recommendation for $891,015,981.
Okay. Representative Schrader now moves Senate Bill 5538 with $91,016,981 and 177 FTE to the full Ways and Means Committee with a due-pass recommendation. Is there discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Kupack?
Aye.
Dean?
Aye.
Lynn?
Aye.
Duke?
Aye.
Snyder?
Aye.
Beck?
Aye.
Schrader?
Aye.
Butler?
Aye.
Cassidy?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
And the motion passes. Who could I get for the Senate to carry the Veterans Budget? Senator Duke, would you like to carry it?
Sure. Senator?
Senator Keita, would you carry the full?
Thank you.
Okay. And somebody for the House, Representative Schrader, will carry the House. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 5538.
Thank you very much.
And open the hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 5522. Welcome to the committee. Would you like to start off and make some opening comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, this is the budget bill on the Public Utility Commission, Senate Bill 5522. Jamie and I have just distributed for you copies of the LFO analysis that we put out at the beginning of the session, so that's there for your reference. The good news is there are no budget notes from last session, no interim studies, no audit reports that we have to cover, no fee bills, so we can go right into the presentation. And the Department of Administrative Services analyst would like to do his overview of the governor's budget, and then we would go to the department or the commission presentation.
Okay. Satish, welcome.
Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, this is Satish Upadhyay with the Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management Division, and I come before you today to present to you the Governor's recommended budget for the Public Utility Commission of Oregon for the 9901 biennium. You should have a copy of my presentation document in front of you. The recommended budget is a 5% increase over the 9799 legislatively approved budget. This increase is mainly because of increases in the agency's workload. The workload has increased because of competition and changes taking place in the industries that the commission regulates. The recommended budget continues all the services of the Public Utility Commission. The commission regulates electric and natural gas industries that are owned by investors. It regulates certain telephone and water companies. It also helps ensure that customers receive safe and reliable services at a reasonable rate of return. The Commission does this while ensuring that the industries it regulates also receive a fair rate of return. The Commission has three programs that help the disabled and the low-income. The recommended budget adds 9 positions over the current service level. 6 of these positions are for consumer services. Now, although it adds 9 positions, the workload of 7 of these positions are currently being met by temporary employees and by existing employees doing overtime. As a result, the Commission is not asking for any increase in limitation, expenditure limitation for 7 of these positions. The recommended budget reclassifies positions to carry out the classification plan that was approved by the Emergency Board at its January 1998 meeting. The recommended budget also funds for increased attorney services and includes expenditure limitation for the Commission to provide administrative support for the Land Use Board of Appeals. I would now like to tell you how the recommended budget was developed. The starting point was the 9799 legislatively adopted budget. This consisted of around $27 million total funds. $144,000 of this was federal funds, and it consisted of 109 full-time equivalent positions. There was one emergency board action. This was carried by the Department of Administrative Services, and it was for all state agencies. This was for employee compensation cost increases. And there were current service level budget adjustments for position and inflationary cost changes. The governor's budget has 8 policy packages. 5 of these packages are under the utility program unit. I will briefly talk to you about the packages. The agency will talk about them more in detail during their presentation. Under the utility program, package 101 provides $230,806 other funds and $3,214 federal funds for reclassification of positions to implement the classification plan that was approved by the emergency board at its January 1998 meeting. Package 103 allows the commission to use more attorney general services. Package 105 establishes two positions to conduct safety and engineering inspections of utilities. Package 106 allows the commission to contract out with an outside party to monitor the utility auctioning process. And package 107 is just a fund switch. It allows the agency to use federal funds in place of other funds for a gas safety program. Under the administrative policy and administration program unit, there are three policy packages. Package 102, it has no fiscal impact. It just corrects some reclassification problems in the administrative hearings, consumer services, and administrative support section. Now, package 104, it provides 7 full-time equivalent positions. This is for 6 of these positions are for consumer services and 1 is for administrative hearings. Again, as I mentioned earlier, all of these, the workload of all of these positions are currently being done by temporary employees and by existing employees doing overtime. As a result, there is no fiscal impact. And lastly, package 108 allows the agency to provide administrative support for the Land Use Board of Appeals. If you turn to the last page, and there is one technical adjustment. This is for package 105. It's just a fund shifting of $52,029 other funds from services and supplies to personal services. This will help us track down expenditures correctly. Lastly, under the governor's revised budget, there's a reduction of the services and supplies budget for the Residential Service Protection Fund. This reduction is for $677,199 other funds. This is based on some new information we received from the agency after the governor's recommended budget came out. I'll be glad to answer any questions that you have.
Okay, are there any questions?
Yes.
Senator Cubeb, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, I just was wondering, Satisha, on the second page, the expenditure limitation of PUC includes the administrative support for the Land Use Board of Appeals. Why is that?
PUC provides administrative support for the Land Use Board of Appeals. The Land Use Board of Appeals is a small agency. They don't have enough staff to do their administrative work. So basically, they are housed at PUC. They were, I think, at the state library before they moved to PUC, and PUC helped them provide administrative support.
Arbitrary selection because of their location?
Basically, it's because of their location.
And DAF doesn't. Why does DAF not do it?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Cubeb, I think it's, there's more cost savings if PUC does.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Schrader.
Next question on package 105. I don't know if it's for Keith or maybe for the agency to describe why we need that. If they haven't been doing it before, is this new or is this just augmenting what they've been doing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, I'll tell you a little bit about it and the agency can jump in. This is this package is required because of the federal guidelines. The agency receives federal funds for gas, for the safety and engineering inspections of utilities. Or in fact, I think there's a federal requirement. The Fed came up with a report, in fact, that requires the agency to have much more employees dedicated for this. So it is a federal requirement. And this is an ongoing program. They are just adding more employees because of increased demand.
Representative Patrick.
Leading off from the Veterans Affairs budget, are there any changes on personnel that will cause a reduction in classifications or there's some potential failure?
Mr. Chair, Representative Patrick, this agency is very different than Veterans Affairs. The problem that PUC is facing is retention of employees. They have very high caliber, the rate analysts, utility analysts, And in fact, they had one of their employees leave. I remember during last session, during the last buy-in, hired by one of the companies that the industry, but that the PUC regulates at almost double the salary that PUC is paying. PUC, from what I know, a lot of their employees are not hired at the second step. They have to hire them at a higher step. Otherwise, most of their employees are like rate analysts, and these people have to be have knowledge in economics, engineering, and quality analysis and all that. So this is a different kind of agency. And Mr. Chair, Representative Patrick, there is a little bit of savings in another vacancy savings, and it's tracking around $12,000. That's another current service level that we calculated. So there's not that much savings.
Okay, further questions? Senator Lemon.
This is a bit of funding. Funds, 1995-97 is almost in the $800,000, and current biennium is $155,000, and then it goes away, so it's just not big, the federal fund.
Mr. Chair, how do you have the agency answer that?
I'm not sure which federal funds you're referring to.
He's looking at this right here. And if you look at the summary totals up above, it says federal funds $799,984 for the 95-97 actual, 97-99 estimated. It drops down to $155,000, and the current service level is $160,032. Is that?
Yes, that's right.
Chair, Senator Lim, I believe the reason for that is back in that biennium, we had 6 months of the transportation program in there, and they had federal funds. That's why it was so high. The motor carrier program moved to the Department of Transportation, and the funds went with it.
Thank you.
Further questions? If not, Ron Eakins, the chairman of DAC, would you like to make any comments or present your presentation?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ron Eakins. I'm chairman of the Oregon Public Utility Commission. The other two commissioners are Commissioner Roger Hamilton and Commissioner Joan Smith. They are unable to be here today because they are conducting a public meeting over the Public Utility Commission. I thought what we would do is first give just a general agency overview, and then based on a previous conversation at your request, Mr. Chairman, we have prepared a couple of documents to give an overview of the major history of the Public Utility Commission, and since at least 1987, when the three-person Public Utility Commission was created by a 1986 ballot measure referred by the legislature. And I thought with those, then it should give a pretty good idea of the agency itself, what we do and what some of the major issues and type of activities. So we thought we would start with that. We do have a couple of visuals to use. And then I have a document I think has been passed out that I refer to.
Representative Schrader, just real quick before we get started, is this separate from the presentation of the books that we have?
Yes. You should have a...
You'll be receiving a handout shortly.
Yeah. Mission of the Public Utility Commission is the fair regulation of utility industries, ensuring safe, reliable service to the public at just and reasonable rates through an open decision-making process. This mission really comes out of a combination of statutes. It incorporates fairness, it incorporates safety, it incorporates just and reasonable rates, and it incorporates an open decision-making process, all of which are required by law. In addition, the law, at least in telecommunications, encompasses what we believe is really another basic objective of ours, not the mission, and that is to encourage innovation within the industry by a balanced program of regulation and competition. We have a number of our primary services, and I think Satish went over some of these. But basically, we are to determine the reasonable rates and adequate services for the regulated utilities and this includes the investor-owned electric, natural gas, telecommunications, and water companies, which we regulate in various degrees. Some companies are regulated to a higher degree than others by statute. We're also in charge of protecting the public safety through electric and natural gas safety requirements and through making sure that utilities provide adequate utility service. Another major program and primary service of the Commission is to provide telephone assistance services. This is done primarily through what's called the Residential Service Protection Fund, created in 1987 by the legislature, funded by a surcharge on bills, on telephone bills, and you may hear the term RSPF used, and that's what we're referring to. This provides, it matches funds for assistance to low, matches federal funds for assistance to low-income persons. It provides the deaf, the hearing, or the speech-impaired, and other persons with severe physical impairments the ability to use the telephone through two methods. One is the provision of devices that allow them to use the telephone, and the other is providing a 24-hour telephone relay services, both of which are required now by federal law. Those are our primary services. What I'd like to do now with that general overview is perhaps give you an idea of sort of the history in both telecommunications and natural gas. You should have a document, two documents, one, history of telecommunications policies and programs, which I will be referring to. And I think this will give you an idea of sort of the how we got to this point in time and what the major issues have been in telecommunications over a period of time. This is not all that we do. These are highlights, these are key elements, major events, milestones, if you will, as we look back, but they are not everything that we do, nor are they every decision we've made. While I said that the Oregon Public Utility Commission changed from a one-person commission to a three-person commission in 1987 based on a 1986 ballot measure, which passed by 75% of the vote, that provides a starting point to go through the history, basically, of the three-person commission. But I think in telecommunications it's important to go back to the 1985 legislature, because that was legislation that passed after the 1984 court ordered breakup of AT&T and the Bell operating companies, and the state of Oregon redid its telecommunications statutes in relation in light of that court decision. It had some key features to it. One is it did allow competition for intrastate tolls, often referred to as local toll as opposed to interstate toll, which is federal communications jurisdiction, private line and shared services. Allowed incumbent local exchange companies to price list services, and by price list we mean they could change their prices on short notice without having to come to the commission with a tariff if they were subject to competition or if they were non-essential. It also allowed them to deregulate an individual service with commission approval if effective competition in fact existed. It required all providers of service to get a certificate of authority from the Public Utility Commission. It did allow the Commission to create subsidies to assure services that they had available, services were available at reasonable rates. It provided that there was no rate regulation for competitors to local exchange companies. At the same time, it also only allowed local exchange service competition with the consent of the incumbent utility. And then in 1986, the commission changed. In 1987, the legislature then passed important legislation that allowed the utilities to petition for what we call, and you'll often hear the term A4, which means an alternative form of regulation. This basically allowed them to petition the commission and get a form of regulation that allowed them to price list all of their services and allowed the commission to establish conditions for that. same time, the legislature created the Residential Service Protection Fund, which I've already described. The legislature did that prior to federal law. We were one of the early states to do it. Later, I can't remember the date, with the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act, all states were required to do what Oregon had already begun to do. In 1988, U.S. West filed for an A4 petition and presented a plan. At that time, the commission initiated a review of the plan, a review of company earnings, and of their service quality. We needed to do that in order to determine some starting points for adoption of any plan. In 1989, we adopted what's called the Oregon Customer Access Plan to preserve affordable local telephone service in high-cost areas of the state. This is basically a universal service plan. Its key features were that it was to exist for 5 years, subject to extension, and it was funded by a surcharge on statewide intrastate long-distance access fees. Every time you make a long-distance call, there's an access fee that's included as part of that. The current OCAF fund is 0.00, surcharge, excuse me, is 0.003. It goes into a pool, and then it's distributed out to the high-cost companies. As a first step towards the alternative form of regulation for U.S. West, we ordered them to reduce rates by $24.1 million. In 1990, after the rate case, we made, I think, what was a milestone decision for the state of Oregon for what we'd hope would be opening of eventual competition. We determined that telecommunications services should be unbundled into network elements for use by competitors, so that a competitor could buy an individual element from a local exchange company if it needed that element in order to provide service to the customer. And we concluded that the prices for the telecommunications services and the unbundled elements should be based on incremental costs, or what we consider to be the economic costs. And we began an investigation. This was 6 years before passage of the Federal Telecommunications Act, which basically required the same thing. The Oregon Commission was one of the first states in the country to do this. And at the time of the passage of the Telecommunications Act, which required everyone else to do this, we were only one of five states that had gone very far in this process. Also during that year, in our review of U.S. West service quality, we informed U.S. West that it needed to improve its service quality and significantly reduce the number of what we call held orders before it can receive an alternative form of regulation. Held orders are basically commitments to provide service that are not met on time. Then we also approved AT&T's request for rate deregulation. AT&T had the ability to petition for this under the 1985 Act. They petitioned for it in 1990, and we basically approved the rate deregulation under conditions that they continue to provide basic toll services throughout Oregon as a carrier of last resort, and that they do so at average rates. In 1991, then, we realized that U.S. West, that we needed a new starting point for any alternative form of regulation that U.S. West adopted. So we ordered U.S. West rates reduced by another $35.7 million, and we had our starting point for U.S. West's alternative form of regulation. We then approved the five-year plan, and there are some key features of this. One is it had a rate freeze for essential services. Two, it had pricing flexibility with maximum price caps for non-essential services. It had a sharing of revenue growth between the company and customers. And important to U.S. West, it expanded the earnings opportunity for the company. So basically, in 1991, we began what one could call a price cap method of regulation for U.S. West that was to extend through 1996, gave the company the opportunity to earn a higher rate of return than it otherwise would. In 1992, the A4 plan went into effect. And another key element in moving towards competition in 1992 was that a competitor, Electric Light Wave Incorporated, applied to provide local exchange service. But if you recall, in the 1985 law, you can't provide local exchange service unless the local exchange company consents. And we found, after going through the application, that the only thing that justified not allowing them to provide this service was that the state law didn't allow it without the utility's consent. Consequently, in 1993, the commission proposed a law that would allow competition for local exchange service without the prior consent of the incumbent utility and created competitive zones in which those competitors were offering the service. Again, prior to Telecommunications Act, Oregon was one of the few states, again, that had opened up the local exchange for competition. We used the new competitive zone law to grant ELI's application to provide private line service. Private line service is from point to point dedicated as opposed to your normal dial tone service that goes through the switched network. At the same time, continuing with our desire to unbundle the network elements, we adopted a methodology for calculating the cost. As you can see, it took almost 2 years for the commission to go through breaking down the network and trying to determine what the individual elements were and what should be the methodology for its cost. The reason it took that long, it is, was the first time that we had actually, being not only the commission but the companies themselves, had actually begun to look at the network in that way. So it was quite an extensive process. In fact, we had most of the western states waiting for the state of Oregon to complete its process so they could incorporate it and adopt it. By 1994, some of the major events are listed here: a rate reduction in GTE and a deregulation of an individual service. 1995, however, saw...
Who directed the PUC to refund their customers the $2 million on ballot measure 5 savings?
The commission made that decision based on previous orders. The utilities' costs for property taxes are considered costs of doing business and are built into rates. When ballot measure 5 significantly reduced the utility costs that had previously been built into rates, we went back and reduced the rates accordingly.
It's interesting, we've heard the Hugh and Craig discussion about increasing corporate tax rates, but if you're a corporate utility and you increase your taxes or receive a benefit, then the PUC makes a legislative decision on determining who gets the effect of Measure 5. Is that correct?
And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I wouldn't call it a legislative decision other than that we've been delegated the responsibility to make sure that rates are just and reasonable. We base just and reasonable upon what are the costs to the utility. If the utility's costs increase because of tax increases, or if they decrease because of tax decreases, those increases or decreases we would then reflect in rates.
Okay. Questions, Representative Butler?
Along that line, Mr. Chair, as we're now under Measure 47, Measure 50, you've been taking into consideration the 3% increases that are given each year in local taxation fees, and then allow increases in the rates corresponding with.
Increases in taxes would be taken into account. Whether or not they result in the increases actual increases in rates or not may depend upon whether or not other costs went up or down. But in calculating what the utility's costs are and their ability to recover those costs, we take into account any tax increases as well as any tax decreases.
Follow up. In the 1994 order, GTE Northwest
reduces rates by 5.2 million annually on a refund of $2 million because of ballot measure 5. Other telephone companies weren't required to do similar.
All telephone companies were required in some manner to reflect the benefits of the ballot measure 5 savings.
What is GTE mentioned separately here? The other companies?
We didn't go through representatives in the in this and use all of the orders. This was just one of the major rate orders that we did in 1994.
GTE perhaps the largest manager of life.
No, U.S. West representative is the largest, but I think this was the major rate case we had in 1994.
So they would have, if they were the largest, and they had the largest savings on the ballot measure 5, then they would have refunded to their customers something in excess of $2 million and reduced their rates by something in excess of $5.2 million.
Yes, I believe Representative U.S. West was in the range of $4 to $5 million.
Of savings that were refunded back to the customers.
Yes.
But in the form of a check that's sent back to customers? Or just years reductions in
refunds, Mr. Chairman, Representative, can be done in several ways. Often, it's done in terms of a check. Often, it's done in terms of a credit on your bill.
The only other concern that I have is as you show a pattern of reducing telecommunications budgets and asking for refunds. It goes back to 1987 where U.S. West was to reduce rates by $45.5 million annually. And you look at today's current service level of U.S. West and it's a shambles. And the reason they say it's in shambles is that you've had to direct them to give back the money, so they don't have the money to invest. Now, that's what my constituents are told.
Okay.
And when my constituents get upset, then I get upset. And right now, they're deeply concerned about U.S. West and all these other utilities that are being directed to give back these substantial refunds. And then not having enough money to invest in the community and then receiving the criticism of the community and the PUC for not investing in the community. Now, to me, it points out a vicious catch-22. And what we would like to do as we go through your budget here is certainly work with you, but I think there are some serious questions that we have in this committee that we'd like to see addressed.
Well, Senator, if I could respond, I think it is false, and if you are being told by any utility that the reason they don't have enough money to invest is that the commission has taken it away from them, that is a false and misleading statement.
What was the reason behind Senate Bill 142? Is to get telecommunications service out to Eastern Oregon.
Senator,
are you telling me I'm sleepwalking? I didn't really see the bill. It really didn't mean that. Didn't mean rural improvement.
Senator, you said that the utilities are saying the reason they can't make these investments is that we have taken money away from them or we aren't allowing them adequate dollars. And the sequence of events, I think, when you look into it, shows that that is demonstrably not true, particularly in U.S. West case.
Well, I can tell you the utilities haven't said anything because I even asked their lobby to come and testify. And their belief was that it was retaliation if they came in and said anything negative.
Okay.
So when the purse strings are conducted by someone else, it's hard to come in and be critical or complimentary or anything else because you own the purse strings to the utilities. And quite frankly, the reason this room isn't standing full of utility lobbyists is they're sick and tired of the intimidation and everything else that goes on over there at the PUC.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I take offense at that. I don't believe we've operated in an intimidating manner. I wasn't aware that any utility had any problem with any specific issue in our budget. I know they have objections to the positions that we've taken on substantive legislation, but I can show you, if you wish to take the time, how U.S. West got into its position, and it is not because we took money away from them. In fact, the A4 in which we gave them in 1991 allowed them the opportunity to earn more money than they would otherwise earn. And if you, and the history is that we also established some service quality requirements, because you see, price caps are designed to do two things. They are designed, one, to give the utility the ability to respond to competition and lower its prices if it needs to, if it has competition, and to do it quickly. They are also designed to reward the utility for being more efficient. In other words, if they can cut costs, they can earn more, and under the A4, we wouldn't go in and take it away from them. We were concerned, however, that you can also cut costs by cutting service quality, and we built in some standards into the alternative form of regulation. By 1995, U.S. West had violated those service standards. So during this period of time, when we were not regulating their rates, and when they were allowed to earn a higher rate of return, their service quality deteriorated to the point that we ended the alternative form of regulation because they violated the agreement. Now, prior to that, in setting rates, we go through and we determine what are the utility's costs to provide service, provide adequate and reliable service, and we allow them cost recovery on that, and we allow them a reasonable rate of return on that. Now, if you have a declining cost industry, such as telecommunications, that is also growing, you have situations in which their revenues go up, their costs go down, we come in and readjust rates to make sure ratepayers are not paying any more than they otherwise would have. That's why prior to 1991, and during this period of time in 1994, with GDE, we made adjustments to rates so that utilities would not be spending, our customers would not be paying more than necessary for the maintenance and the provision of service. In 1996, when we terminated that A4, as the history would show, we opened up a rate case. We determined that U.S. rates should be reduced, because to keep them at the level they were meant that ratepayers would be paying more than they should. And that's to maintain existing services, not for the provision of advanced services. Senate Bill 142 was designed to focus on advanced services, and it allowed U.S. West to basically buy its way out of regulation prior to any competition, and that's why the commission opposed it. In addition, it went back and affected the rate case we had in 1997. U.S. West, if it makes investments, will get rates that cover those costs, and it will get a reasonable rate of return on that. Now, I don't understand.
What is the definition, or is it by statute, what a reasonable rate of return is? I really have a real problem with this, Chairman. You see, my idea of redistribution of wealth to companies is saying, you can make this much over here, but if you make $1 more, you got to give this back.
We have not said that. Rates are based upon changes in costs. Some costs go up, some costs go down. So you may have offsetting impacts. It also includes revenues have to cover those costs plus a reasonable rate of return. If the revenues from the company are not adequate to do that, we would in fact raise rates. What's occurred historically is that the revenues have, with the telecommunications industry, from time to time, rather than revenues being too little and therefore having to raise rates, revenues have in fact gone high. The return on equity has gone beyond what we think is a reasonable rate of return, and we have reduced rates. Reasonable rate of return is determined in a public utility commission proceeding a contested case proceeding based upon the evidence that is presented. There is usually a range that's established. For example, you might say that a reasonable return, because this is not an exact science, is somewhere between 10 and 15%. But in order to set rates, you have to pick a point. So we might pick something in the middle and say a reasonable rate of return is 12.5%. We set rates based upon that. In between rate cases, the utility may earn more or less. If the utility earns something that goes above, say, the 15, which was the range, to 17, 18, we may come in and say we think rates are too high and we may make adjustments. If it goes too low, the company comes in, says we need a rate change. In U.S. West case, the last rate case we did, we needed a starting point for their alternative form of regulation. The second rate case we did was when the alternative form of regulation ended in 1996, and we completed the rate case in 1997. But as far as I know, U.S. West is the only company that has requested price cap under existing law. I believe under existing law, GTE will come in this year and request something to that effect. But since we recently changed their rates, we probably will not have to do a rate case for a starting point. Oh. But to do otherwise, the reasonable rate of return is determined in the rate case proceeding because cost of capital changes over time.
I understand, and I still don't feel like I've got the answer to 1994, where you reduced rates by 5.2 million GTE and you refunded the customers 2 million in ballot measure 5 savings. I'm not aware the legislature gave anybody in business anywhere a refund or an order to refund the savings off of measure 5. And I'm trying to find out if your rate of return is predicated on 5.2%, why did you direct an additional $2 million for the ballot measure 5 savings? I'm just having a hard time reconciling that the PUC has taken upon themselves to say because there's a cost savings instead of the ballot measure, let's give back some additional money to the people, and it really doesn't figure in the equation of a profit margin.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it did figure in the equation for the profit margin.
Were any other utilities directed to give back measure 5?
Yes, all utilities, in one way or another, returned the dollars to ratepayers for the ballot measure 5 savings. Every one of them. And I believe in the situation of the other, with the exception of U.S. I believe there was a memorandum of understanding or an agreement signed with the companies and the commission as to how to handle ballot measure 5 savings. U.S. West, because it was in the alternative form of regulation, we treated somewhat differently, but eventually that money was, in fact, returned to ratepayers. It was done by agreement with the companies, and it was done to reflect the changes in costs. It was done under our existing statutes to set reason, make sure that rates are just and reasonable. In other cases where there are increases in costs, those increases in taxes would be reflected in rates. Ballot measure 5 savings were fairly substantial, and I have to go back, but I believe we reached an agreement with the companies after the passage of ballot measure 5, including the gas companies, as to how ballot measure 5 savings would be treated. It was by agreement with the companies.
Representative Patrick.
You said previously that this is that these are in terms of telecommunication, this is a declining cost industry. Can you expand on what you mean by that? It seems like information to me is moving so quickly, and we are changing things so quickly. And the number of cellular phones I bought over the course of years to keep up with things, and I don't understand how it's a declining cost industry. It seems like this telecommunication industry is moving so rapidly, and the investment in infrastructure needs to be so rapid. And then at the same time, we're ordering U.S. West and other GTE to return money back to its customers in the market. kind of with the wireless market moving in and everything else. I'm just wondering why and how you're saying this is at the coin toss industry and why there's recent advanced intelligence case.
Chairman, members of the committee, it's become a declining cost industry because the new technology actually makes it more efficient, and because the cost of the new technology declines over time, just as the cost of your wireless phone has probably declined over time since they were initially introduced. And so what you have here is that the cost of providing particular services decline by whatever units of measure you use, they decline over time. You can serve more customers at less cost per customer because technology makes it more efficient and because the cost of that technology declines from the point in time when it's initially introduced. It's a fairly common economic occurrence, and that's what we refer to it as the declining cost industry. And all of the data for telecommunications companies indicates that that's the case.
And Mr. Chair, as a follow-up, I don't understand, but there still has to be some initial capital investment that goes along with this. There still has to be, you know, investment in wireless. There still has to be investment in voicemail technologies. There still has to be research and development that's moving forward in these industries.
Correct.
It's great that we can make that the cost is declining, but hopefully you make it attractive to more people. But, you know, I'm faced with a situation in Medford where we had to wait months sometimes because there wasn't investment in the local switch.
Right.
And at the same time, in 1996, I'm looking ahead, or 97, ordering US West to reduce their rates by almost $100 million and refund $100 million.
Mr. Chairman, representatives and members of the committee, I think there is an assumption here that somehow by reducing the rates, you're reducing the amount the utility has to invest. And that's not correct. First, the utility gets the money to invest through depreciation on its existing, and it gets the money through growth in the system, growth in the usage of the system. What the rates reflect are you take the cost of the new investments that you say you want, and it means that existing rates provide an excessive rate of return on the investments that the utility is making. The utility has the money to make the investments, and the utility, if the utility needs to make more investments to keep up its network and has the ability to come to us and get additional money if it needs it. So it gets the money through growth in the system, through depreciation, and through profits. And it has a decision as to whether how much of the profits it's going to reinvest in the network. And our problem with a company like US West has been that it has not maintained its network, but it is not because we have ordered them to refund money, because it's not because of any regulatory decision. I can show you instances in which they had planned to make investments, in which they postponed those. In fact, with the switches, they came to us in 1995. They asked for accelerated depreciation in order to replace the 13 analog switches, the only analog switches that still existed in the state, between 1996 and 1999, and we gave them accelerated depreciation as they asked. It was a $14 million benefit to the company. Since then, they have replaced only two, until the problems in Roseburg occurred. Until recently, they had made no announcements to replace any of them. So we gave them accelerated depreciation so those could be replaced. They chose not to do it. I can show you data that shows that in 1998, they made more money, had increased profits, increased revenues, they actually spent less in 98 than you did in 1997. And it's not because they weren't making money. Their ratio of investment to profit in 98 actually went down compared to where it was in 97, even though they made a higher return on equity. It's not, you cannot compare the revenue requirement reduction with the investment because the, with my utility not having the money to make the investment because the rates that are set and the revenues that we allow are based on the investments the utility makes and should make. Our concern now is that the utility should be making investments, but it is not making those investments. Our concern is that they should be maintaining a level of quality of service, but they are not maintaining that level of quality of service. And in fact, we penalized the company in our rate case because we didn't believe ratepayers should be paying for steak and getting hamburger.
Senator Lim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The utility company, especially here in the U.S. West, you just mentioned you get them accelerated depreciation. Also, you mentioned they made up about $16 million.
14.
Or 14, whatever. When you give them, do you have a written agreement that they have to invest a certain amount of money to replace the antiquated facility, or are you just to let them do it as their own schedule?
We gave them the accelerated depreciation on the basis of their promise, their expectation, their claim that they needed the accelerated depreciation in order to replace the switches between 1996 and 1999. We did it based upon their claim. And that was the purpose of doing it. Otherwise, we would have kept the depreciation rates as they were because the plants were still going to be in service and there was no reason to change the depreciation schedule. We changed the depreciation schedule upon their assertion. They created the expectation. They made the claim that they would do this between 1996 and 1999. We do not have the authority to tell any utility in what they can invest. We only have the authority to determine which costs will be included in rates. Now, this had a $14 million benefit to them. When we discovered that it wasn't done, we then went back and made some regulatory arrangements that would make sure the ratepayers were not harmed by accelerated depreciation that was not utilized. But we ended up that by 1998, all of those switches had been fully depreciated, but only two of them had been replaced. The utility was given dollars to invest, and they did not get it.
Is that a approximately good place to stop the Senate news at 10 this morning? And need to allow the members a little time to go to their offices. And if we can pick up on this again tomorrow.
We'll start in 1995.
Representative Schrader.
Just so it'd be helpful maybe to, if it's okay to see maybe a little sheet on how the property tax stuff was handled for the other utilities, you know, how they got their money back also.
Sure, we can do that. I believe I can give you, there is an agreement, I believe, a stipulation that almost all the utilities signed, and U.S. West was the exception, not out of the, you all recognize there would be an exception because they were in this alternative form of regulation.
My point out to committee members, there's a new schedule been printed out and handed out to you this morning. This week, we're going to be on the PUC tomorrow. The PUC and Boley on Wednesday. ODOT back on Thursday and Friday. Now, if we get back on schedule, which I'm hoping to do by Friday morning, then we will not have to have future Friday meetings. So we're close to being back on schedule, but we're not quite there yet, but we're moving closer. So, if there's no further discussion, we're adjourned until 8 a.m. tomorrow.
It does not, however,